Okay, good evening, and welcome to the second half of Tishrei in a Day, running from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. We've now completed our discussion of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Everybody knows all there is to know, and now it's time for us to jump to Sukkot, Shmini Atzeres, Simchas Torah, and there is certainly a lot to talk about here. I put the link in the chat for the source packets. This year is page 26. In the source packets. I will share as I need to for some of the sources, but overall, as you know, I much prefer to see people and not be looking at the source sheet. I am recording this, and if I like the way it comes out, it will go up on YouTube, so if anyone does not want to be visible, then understood. Otherwise, I'm very happy to see people's faces when I'm talking to them. All right. The program overall today is dedicated in memory of Ben Lax, Zichrono Livracha, Dov Ben Mordechai, by his loving family. And then this session in particular is dedicated by Abraham Freilich, Judith Todd Habo and Judah Habo, Esther and Bob Libman, Carla and Jules Sulzbach, and by myself, actually, by Karen and Mordechai Turchiner, in honor of Jeanette Adams and the Skan and Avrechim of our Beit Midrash. For the rest of the dedications, including their full text, look at the source sheet, but we only have half an hour, and I want us to get started on the shir, even as I continue to admit people from the chat. So here's what I would like to talk about under the heading of the two Sukkot of Zerubbabel. There's a very strange account of Sukkot that appears in the book of Nehemiah, from early in the Second Temple, the Second Beit HaMikdash. And that's actually where we're going to start our discussion. And even though normally I don't share screen, in this case I'm going to, because I think it'll be worthwhile to make sure that everybody sees this source from Nehemiah. This is from Chapter 8. It is actually the end of a chapter that Rabbi Metzger invoked this morning. He read about the celebration of Rosh Hashanah. So here we're going to be talking about the celebration of Sukkot later in that same month. Take a look at this, please. And as I noted this morning, I'm just going to read out the English for the sake of time, but you can see the original, authentic Hebrew there as well. And on the second day, this is probably the second day of Tishrei. The way they would have observed Rosh Hashanah at that point, if it was 2 days at all, would have been the last day of Elul and first day of Tishrei. So this is now the second day of Tishrei, the commentators understand. All of the nation's heads of clans, the Kohanim, the Leviim, gathered to Ezra the Sofer. I don't like to call him the scribe, because that's probably not what Sofer actually means here. In any case, they all gathered to Ezra to gain insight into the words of the Torah. And they found recorded in the Torah, which God commanded via Moshe, that Israel should sit in Sukkot on the holiday in the seventh month, and that they should announce and transmit a message through all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, "Go out to the mountain and bring olive branches and branches of oil wood and myrtle branches and date branches and branches of the braided tree and make Sukkot as recorded." So here we are. This is relatively early on in the Second Temple period. I don't want to give you a year or even a generation yet for reasons that will become clear later on. But the Jews gather to Ezra, they read in the Torah, and they say, "Huh, there's this thing called Sukkot. What do you know? And we should go out to the mountain and bring these branches." It is not coincidental that some of those branches are the branches used for the Arba Minim, Lulav Esrog, and so on. Not all of the Arba Minim, but some of them. That's not our discussion right now, though. And the nation went out and brought, and they made Sukkot for themselves, each on his roof and in their yards and in the yards of the house of God and in the plaza by the water gate. That was where they had originally read the Torah aloud, and in the plaza by the Ephraim gate. And the entire community who had returned from captivity made Sukkot, and they dwelled in Sukkot. For Israel had not done thus since the days of Joshua son of Nun until that day. And there was very great joy. And he, Ezra probably, read from the book of the Torah of God each day, from the first day to the last day, and they made a 7-day celebration and a festival on the 8th day, as per the law. So what you get in this chapter, right, in chapter 8 of the book of Nehemiah, seems to be, surprise, there's this thing called Sukkos. Here's what you do. Go to the mountain, get a bunch of branches, put them together, make huts, and live in them. Oh, and we haven't done that since the days of Joshua. This is exceedingly problematic. Not only is it problematic to imagine that King David never sat in a sukkah, right? Of course, we actually say on Sukkot, in Birkat HaMazon, HaRachmanu Yakim Lanu at Sukkot David HaNofal, that's about the Beis HaMikdash. Nonetheless, the idea that Chizkiyahu never saw the celebration of Sukkot, the idea that David never saw the celebration of Sukkot, Yoshio never saw the celebration, what are you talking about? Why is that? Yeshaya didn't celebrate Sukkot? What in the world does that even mean? But it's even worse. Backtrack a second. What we read was from the 8th chapter of the book of Nehemiah. Remember that in Tanakh, we have two books that are presented in sequence. Ezra and Nehemiah. They're really one book. They're not two books. They were divided up by people who were not of ours. This is not our decision to split up Ezra and Nehemiah. There's a lot of discussion as to why it's split up. It's its own discussion, not for right now. But the point is, Ezra and Nehemiah are really one book that happens to end up as two. So keeping that in mind, envision for yourself the book of Ezra and then the book of Nehemiah. The story we just read is the 8th chapter in the book of Nehemiah. I am now going to rewind to the beginning of the book of Ezra, chapter 3 in the book of Ezra. In chapter 1, Cyrus said, it's time for the Jews to return to their land. We're going to come to him in a minute, or in a few minutes. We read about the return and a census of those who returned in chapter 2. And then you get to chapter 3 in the book of Ezra. And here is where things really get perplexing. So even though, as I said, I don't like to share a screen, I'm going to share a screen for this one, so I won't be able to see your jaw drop when you look at source number 2, right? We read in source number 1 that Nehemiah has this record of the celebration of Sukkot, and no one's done it before, and everybody's really surprised and all of that. Well, take a look at source number 2 now from that third chapter in Ezra. Sorry, just letting in more people from the waiting room. Okay. And the 7th month arrived. This is right after we arrived in the land. We dispersed to our cities, as recorded in chapter 2. And then the 7th month arrived, the month of Tishrei. And Israel were in their cities. And the nation gathered as one to Jerusalem. They said, let's leave our cities and come to Jerusalem. 7th month, Tishrei. And Yehoshua ben Yehotzadak, the Kohen Gadol, and his brethren Kohanim, and Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel, I want to talk about him in a minute, and his brethren arose, and they built an altar for the God of Israel, the beginnings of a Beis HaMikdash, of a temple, upon which to elevate burnt offerings as recorded in the Torah of Moshe, the man of God. And they prepared the altar on its foundations, for they were afraid of the nations of the lands. I'm going to come back to that phrase later. And they brought burnt offerings upon it in the morning and evening. And they performed the holiday of Sukkot, as recorded. And each day's burnt offering on its day, according to the number, as per the law, each day it's due. And then the daily burnt offerings, and for the months, and for all the festivals of God which have been consecrated, and for all who volunteered an offering to God. In other words, highlighting it, they performed the holiday of Sukkot as recorded in Ezra chapter 3. So why is it that when you got to Nehemiah chapter 8, no one had heard of Sukkot? I don't understand. I'm completely missing what happened between Ezra chapter 3 and Nehemiah chapter 8. It doesn't seem to follow anything. And what am I supposed to learn from it? So by investigating this question, what I want to do is bring us to an understanding not just of what was going on in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, but what's going on when we celebrate Sukkot today. So let's backtrack and talk a little bit about the return of the Jews for the second Beit HaMikdash. Recall that in Yeshaya chapter 44, God predicted a king by the name of Cyrus who would send the Jews back from their exile to the land. Right? We've talked about that in other shiurim and other classes. Not the topic for right now. Cyrus is extremely magnanimous. This is Cyrus's method in general of conquest. We know this from separate historical records, the Cyrus Cylinder and so on, that he thought, you know, instead of conquering people and spending all of your energy and all of your resources trying to keep them in line, what you have to do is co-opt them. Show that you're on their side. So we have a record of how he told the Babylonians, because he was Persian, after he conquered the Babylonians, your God has commissioned me to lead you and build up your temples and so on. And he does the same thing for the Jews. He says, I'm going to help you build your temple. And I'm not going into this now. Some of you were actually with me to learn Ezra and Nehemiah several years ago. And you're going to recall that when we did this, we talked about the fact that he has them build the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, as essentially the Persian Empire Beit HaMikdash. If you think of Scotiabank Arena, right? Scotiabank pays a certain amount, and now it's Scotiabank Arena. So it is Persian government, Beit HaMikdash of the Jews. That's what he does. And there's all sorts of evidence for that in the text. That's what he thinks he's doing, even though, as the book of Ezra tells us, and as Yeshaya told us before that, Hashem is really manipulating him in order to get this to happen. In any case, we come back to the land with a mission. And our mission, not just a religious mission, but a political mission, is build yourselves a temple. And then we go to the cities instead. And we don't work on the Beit HaMikdash. We didn't do it. We went to the cities. Only when we get to Ezra chapter 3, the seventh month, do we show up. And that's where our story picks up. And I think that's a really important point, as I'm about to explain. You see, the Jews at this point are, well, before that, the Jews at this point have certain leaders. We've already named them. You didn't see Ezra there, right? Did you see Ezra in the text at all? Anyone saw a sign of Ezra besides in the heading? No. Ezra, apparently AWOL. Not there. According to the Medrash, Ezra's hanging out back in Persia because he has to remain learning from Baruch ben Neriah, who was a student of Yirmiyahu. He'll show up later on. Ezra will show up in chapter 7. Ezra's not there. Anyone see any sign of Nehemiah? Apparently not. Now, Nehemiah is not named either. Who did we see? There is Yehoshua Kohen Gadol, who was a descendant of high priests. And there was Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is more than just a word found in Moses Psur. Zerubbabel is actually the name of political leader of the Jews of the time, a focal point for the transition from a nation that had just been licensed by Persia to return, to become a nation that is establishing an autonomous kingdom. Zerubbabel is extremely important. And here I will show you, I'm putting the link again in the source sheet, for the source sheet in the chat, so that those who did not yet download it will be able to, but I am going to share it for this source. You know what? I actually brought it later on my source sheet. Not sure why. But in any case, here it is. Source number 5, Talmud Sanhedrin 38a, which states for us, there was a fellow by the name of Shaltiel, Shenish al-alato kael. God repealed his own vow. God had vowed that King Yechaniah from the end of the first temple would never have a child. God relented and let him have a child. That's Shaltiel. Zerubbabel was the same person, according to this Gemara. Shenizrabbabel, Zerubbabel, he was conceived in Babylon. And what's his name? Nehemiah son of Hakaliah is his name. Nehemiah, for whom the book is named, is actually the same person as Zerubbabel. We're going to come back to that. That matters a great deal. But those are our leaders right now. Yehoshua Kohen Gadol, Zerubbabel, who may also be named Nehemiah. There's also a fellow named Sheshbatzar. I'm not going into him right now. So the Jews, going back up to... scrolling back up to source number 2... the Jews have come to Jerusalem, finally, in the seventh month. And they build an altar. They bring burnt offerings on the altar. It's not yet a full-fledged temple, a full-fledged Beit HaMikdash, and therefore they're not qualified yet to actually make it into a full temple with all of the offerings. They build the altar on the old base out of fear of their neighbors. The commentators explain that they bring their sacrifices in search of divine support against their neighbors. In other words, they build the altar saying, God, please help us. Please assist us. Okay. So, that was our first account of Sukkot in Ezra chapter 3. The Jews are led by these great figures, Yoshua, Kohen Gadol. The Jews are led by Zerubbabel, who also has the name Nehemiah. Again, we're going to come back to that. And they build an altar and they celebrate Sukkot. Tell me something. From what we read in Ezra chapter 3, what do you know about how we celebrate Sukkot? What did they do to celebrate Sukkot? What did you see? We have a lot to talk about. Don't waste time.
Korbanot!
Sacrifices! Sorry? Someone said Shlomo style.
My husband.
Ah, okay.
Can't see him. It doesn't.
No, but he's named there, Leona. I see Harry's name also. So, all right. You have sacrifices. That's it. Contrast that with the accounts that we saw in Nehemiah. Right? In Nehemiah's account, the Jews are led by Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra is, through much of his text, the religious inspiration for the Jews, the conveyor of Jewish tradition, descendant of Kohanim Gedolim himself, although apparently not a Kohen Gadol on his own, teacher of Torah. And then you have Nehemiah, make a long story short, cupbearer of the Persian king, tries to build up the defenses of Jerusalem, fights off their enemies, repairs economic disparity, reinstitutes proper tithing and distribution of the tithes, political leader, not without a religious identity, but primarily a political leader. And Nehemiah institutes this great celebration of Sukkot, following the celebration of Rosh Hashanah, which you heard about from Rabbi Metzger this morning in the beginning of the chapter. You have this celebration of Sukkot, and this again raises certain questions. It raises questions about why is it that they didn't know what happened in Ezra chapter 3. Now, I should note, when the text indicates that the Jews were surprised to learn about Sukkot, some insist that this can't be. Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, who I brought on your source sheet, I am not going to share the screen for that right now because it's not essential to what we're doing, but it's in source number 7 on your source sheet. He says, yeah, the truth of the matter is that most of the Jews at this point are not well educated, and therefore they're not familiar with Sukkot. Fine. In terms of why it says that their Sukkot is one that you haven't seen since the time of Yahushua, it's generally understood that it has to do with the nature of how they celebrated. Not that no one had celebrated, but the way they celebrated. And here I am going to share the screen because it's important to go back and see the text the way that it was first depicted. So I'm going to show you in the Hebrew. What it said was, ויעשו כל הקהל השווים, etc. ישוב הסוכות, כי לא עשו מימי ישוע בן נון קין בני ישראל. The Jews had not done Cain, they had not done like this until that very day. It's not that Sukkot had never been done, but Sukkot had never been done in this way. But what I still don't know is, so what's unique about it? How was this different from their predecessors? What was different? And so that's another question that I want to deal with. But I want to just highlight something. The first account that we saw in Ezra emphasized bringing sacrifices. The second account that we see here in Nehemiah is emphasizing instead how Sukkot is celebrated, right? Leona, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, actually, I've been dealing with this for a while, since I read Parshat Re'eh a couple of weeks ago, where Moshe, when he repeats all the Hagim and how to celebrate them,
yeah,
he doesn't say as in Vayikra to build the Sukkah and the Lulav and the Etrog, he only talks about the korbanot.
Right. So, Leona, I'm going to pause you there. There are different emphases in different areas in Chumash, this is true. But in terms of here we're getting build Sukkot, sit in Sukkot, rejoicing, it's Zman Simchateinu, the time of our joy, a seven-day celebration, followed by Shmini Atzeret. None of that showed up in the Ezra version. So what exactly is this? I have three questions. And in order to make sure that it would be clear, I put the three questions on the sheet because I knew I was covering a lot of ground with this and most people are not up on the details of Ezra and Nehemiah. So I figured, let's give people a little bit of a break here. So if you take a look at source number 8, three questions. Number one, why are the Jews under Nehemiah surprised to learn about Sukkot if it was observed in Ezra chapter 3? Number two, how was this second Sukkot different from all the previous ones? You're telling me they did do it before, so why is this one unique? And why does the first account describe very little karbanot, sacrifices, while the second one gives us all of this detail about it? Those are the questions that I would like to address, and we got 9 minutes to go, so we're going to do it. So first of all, recognize what some of you have probably already surmised. The two accounts, Ezra chapter 3, Nehemiah chapter 8, may well be describing the same event. Malbim floats this idea, although it's not his final answer, nonetheless, for others it is their final answer, that in fact, these are the same event. I put Malbim on your source sheet in source number 9. You can see it there, but I just told you what he said. There are a lot of reasons to take that view. If you want to see more about why to take that view, read the census of the Jews that is found in Ezra chapter 2 and the census of the Jews found in Nehemiah chapter 7, and I think that will go a long way to explaining why this is so appealing. But this is consistent with what we saw in the Gemara before, which said Zerubbabel is Nehemiah. He was named Zerubbabel originally. It's a Babylonian name. Then he comes to the land and he gains this nice Jewish name of Nehemiah. How many people do you know who named their kids Zerubbabel? Seriously. Nehemiah, there's a name for a nice Jewish boy. So that answers the question of why it is that the Jews were surprised about Sukkot in the account in Nehemiah. We said, well, weren't they aware of what was done in Ezra 3? The answer is no, they are the same people who did Ezra 3. Ezra 3 and Nehemiah 8 are the same story. It's the same celebration of Sukkot going on. As far as, there's more to be said, I mean, as far as how this works. And in terms of Nehemiah, how many times did Nehemiah show up in the land? But I don't want to get distracted about it. But we have two different accounts of the same event. And I think the reason for that is because the two parts of Ezra, Nehemiah, again, it's really one book, have different agendas. Sefer Ezra, the part that we call the book of Ezra, is about restoring sanctity, building the altar, building the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, getting Jews to marry other Jews. That's the emphasis in the book of Ezra. Whereas Nehemiah is about restoring the nation, building up their defenses, repairing economic inequality, fighting off the enemies, and once again, getting Jews to marry other Jews, because that was a big issue for the nation as a whole. But fundamentally, we're looking at two aspects of the same story. It's the Sukkot of Zerubbabel, or call it Zerubbabel/Nehemiah. In Ezra, the focus is dedicating the altar. I asked a question. I said, why didn't they start building right when they arrived? The answer may be because they're waiting for Sukkot. Specifically for Sukkot. Because if you were to look back at Malachim Aleph at Kings 1, you would find that when Shlomo HaMelech dedicated the Beit HaMikdash, Chan is trying to say it. I see it. You're on mute. It was in the seventh month. It was on Sukkot, Yom Kippur also, that they dedicated the first temple, the first Beis HaMikdash. This gives their actions a powerful authenticity, which is why it was really important to note, so important that I'm going to go back and share the screen once again so that you can make sure to see it. Back in the account in Ezra chapter 3, the text took care to say multiple times that they did what they did, Ka-kasuf, as was written. Here's one. Vayasu eschag hazukos kakasuv in sentence 4. As it was written, they did it. Kakasuv besaras Moshe in sentence 2. They did it as it was written in the Torah of Moshe. The Jews were trying to reenact what had happened back in the first temple. And they used cedar wood just like in the first temple, and they had layers of marble and wood just like in the first temple. There's much more to it. They're dedicating the Mizbeach, the altar. They're turning to God in prayer. And that's one aspect of Sukkot. But it's not what we're most familiar with when we think of Sukkot. We think of the nation's collective spiritual development, which is seen in Nehemiah. After Ezra holds his public Torah reading, and the people repent, and then you have the speeches that are given in that chapter, which you read about this morning. Sukkot comes along as a communal religious celebration, and the communal aspect is of primary importance. And the Malbim says that's what's unique about this Sukkot that they hadn't been doing. You see, there was a law in the books, which I brought you on your source sheet at number 13. But no, I didn't bring it to number 13, which is good because you don't have time to read it aloud anyway. But it's the Raman Arachayim 637, Tav Reish Lamed Zayin. He says you're not allowed to build a sukkah in a public domain, in a Rishus HaRavim. You're not allowed to build your sukkah in the street because you're taking property away from the public. And therefore, writes the Malbim, the Jews had never had a public sukkah. Going all the way back to the time of Yehoshua. It's in the Malbim in source number 13 on your sheet. They'd never done it. But Ezra came along and he made an enactment. His enactment was that Israel should indeed be available for public celebration, that Israel is not one person's domain. It is a public property, and therefore you're allowed to build a public sukkah in Jerusalem. And all of that is in source 13 on your sheet. So what was new to the nation was the national character of Sukkot, the national celebration, so that in sum, and I know I raced through this, Sukkot has two aspects. One aspect is proximity to God. You see it in our prayers for rain. You see it as we shelter in God's sukkah. And that's what's emphasized in Ezra chapter 3. And then separately, there's the national celebration, collective sukkah building, Simchas Beis HaShoeva, the great joyous celebration in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash. That's what's described in Nehemiah 8, which, by the way, is at the water gate, but I'm not going into that right now. The point is, sukkah has these two aspects. And they're split between Ezra and Nehemiah, because in Ezra the focus is the relationship between us and God, and in Nehemiah the focus is the building of the nation. So we identify these two aspects and we emphasize each one individually. So I have review questions for you. Why was Sukkot and Nehemiah 8 a surprise if they observed it in Ezra 3? The answer is it's the same story. What was special about the Sukkot that they observed in Nehemiah 8? It was communal with a public sukkah. And what do we learn from the two separate accounts? Two aspects of Sukkot. Connection to God and communal celebration. This year, we have very much an Ezra Sukkot. We mark our relationship with God, but we lack the public celebrations. Families are apart. You're not sharing meals in Sukkot. No singing and dancing as we normally would for Simchat Beit HaShoeva. But we can still make it social. We can still share Chol HaMoed meals via Zoom. I grant you, it's not the same thing. And your Wi-Fi has to reach your backyard. Fine. Nonetheless, you can still do something in that regard. I have an idea that I plan to do, and that's to hang the pictures of absent relatives in my sukkah. So that on the wall in the sukkah, we will have pictures of my in-laws who we can't be celebrating Sukkot with this year. And like Nehemiah said for Rosh Hashanah, because it was really for all of the Chagim, all of the Yamim Tovim, Shilchu Manot, send gifts of food to other people, especially to those in need of help with their Chag. There are things we can do to have a Nehemiah Sukkot as well. May we have the Ezra Sukkot of religious celebration. May we have the public Sukkot of Nehemiah as well. And then we will be able, God willing, to merit a day when we will have the full Ezra Sukkot and the full Nehemiah Sukkot in Yerushalayim where it belongs. So thank you very much, and I'm going to turn things over to Ezra.